Mi nombre es Bene, que yo soy tu nene, nena. Ven a mi almena y llena este triste corazón. El cielo pesa, dolor en mi cabeza. Cuidado con lo que dices, carta en la mesa, presa. Ojos vidriosos se descubren envidiosos. Unos de afecto, de favores o de talento, otros pozos.
You're listening to an event that was recorded on October 29th at Florida International University, hosted by One Struggle, with Scott Napolis, a member of Miami Autonomy and Solidarity. Thanks for listening.
Voy esquivando, come mierdas, me meo en el infierno. Doy la cara por aquel que lo merezca. No pido nada a cambio, no pido nada a cambio, no. ¿Vais a venir a por mí?
So today, I'm going to do a presentation. It's actually a little different than I had wanted to do earlier. Between now and then, some things have changed in the world.
Can you just say your name real quick?
Oh, Scott Napolis. Okay. I'm a member of Miami Autonomy and Solidarity. I'm doing this presentation for One Struggle. And the name of the presentation is going to be Recomposition. As you see in a second, that's like a core concept I really want to look at. Basically, this is the frame. What I'm going to talk about today is some things that happen in the working class and jobs and how work was organized. But I kind of want to look at it from a broader perspective, especially since we're kind of in a big crisis. It seems like there's a mood of combativity coming up amongst people. So I wanted to frame the discussion a little bit with some stuff. So I think one thing that's really big is like a trajectory in history, right? Like, how do struggles go up, come down? How do they change? New forces come into play, new movements, new kinds of fights. How do we understand that as revolutionaries, as people trying to change the system? Or destroy it, depending on. And the concept of class recomposition is a useful tool for understanding our particular historical moment and history in general. And we'll get to that in a second. Likewise, I think given that how things are changing and we see how ill-prepared people are for it, we really need to be critical of the things that came before us. Existing ideas, groups, traditions, all the kind of baggage and experience that's come to us, positive and negative. Disclaimer, I'm going to have some stuff in here that the group I'm a part of probably wouldn't agree with, so don't take it to be representative of MAS. A lot of it would, but there's some things that are controversial that I think they probably disagree with. Imagine that we're out on the ocean, and we've been there for a while, right? We're sailing on a boat. The problem is, we've been stuck. We have barely any food or water. There's all these holes in the boat. We know the boat is sinking. We can't find out where the holes are because the boat's really big and complicated and we're just a small group of people. And at the same time, we ourselves are becoming sick, delirious from that whole situation with the boat. I kind of think that's the situation we find ourselves in capitalism right now. We're on something that's in a state of decay, decomposition, and at the same time we're trying to survive and keep ourselves together. We're having to disassemble this boat and construct something new from something that's essentially rotten. That, why this is related to factories and all that stuff, you'll see in a little bit. But I think as we see history move on, the problem is we're not like coming with these pure ideas where everybody's got good intentions and certain people know and we're just ready to change. We ourselves are messed up. So that's why I think we need to really take a critical perspective, looking at ourselves, our roles, everything. Of course, you got to have an obligatory Marx quote in any. I went to a presentation the other week by a factory worker from Detroit. He had worked in auto plants for 30 years, part of a group called League of Revolutionary Black Workers. And he opened up with this quote and then proceeded not to talk at all about factory work in Detroit. So I thought I'd pay you all the same kind of favor. But it's an interesting world, right? So at a certain stage of development, material productive forces of society come into conflict with existing relations of production, blah, 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 blah. From forms of development, the productive forces forces these relations to turn into their fetters, and then begins an era of social revolution. So this is kind of encapsulated what we're going to deal with, right? There's certain forces in capitalism, ways they organize work, ways they organize extracting value. And when those things start to shift or come apart, you enter times of social conflict. And I think it's becoming clear that we're entering one of those. So I want to look at kind of some ones in the past and then see how that worked, how people understood it. All those sorts of things. I actually have videos. You get multimedia, right? So we're going to talk about a couple different models of production, of work, of factories, and I wanted to just show some examples of it so we could have a visual understanding as we're going along. I don't really need any of this stuff. So right, Fordism is a name for production, the assembly lines, like what people think of as factories is kind of the first model we'll be talking about. And as you can see, all the motions that people are doing are very simple, right? Like you have a guy just putting a screw on, and that's his only job. You have somebody placing something. Very simple things, and it's all happening on a line, an automated line with machines. Nobody can stop it. The work just keeps moving and flowing, and the work is very de-skilled, right? Pretty much anybody can just turn these cranks. It's not the kind of thing that has any specialized training or control or power. People working in very close proximity. Fast forward to present production, which some people call the Toyota model, you see almost no workers. Right? Highly automated, all the electrical wiring done by robotics. Very, like, often decentralized production, right? You have very specialized things. Let me see. There's a point at which you find a worker. But you can see that the worker's role has changed a bit, right? They're interfacing with rather complicated technology, often more skilled labor. You don't see it here, but there's often work teams, like you have little production crews. One last little video. That same model of production, which originated in auto, has also been applied all over the place. So this is like a hospital cart. And one thing it has done is it creates like wireless networks that give management information about every motion that a person makes, tracking devices, video cameras, scanning. So that kind of mechanization and level of surveillance and control over the production process has been applied all over the place. So that's just a little few. So we're going to start with some ideas about history. Most of the time when you read stuff, and not just the left, but the everyday media, right? What do you read? You read, oh, the wealthy, the governments did X, Y, and Z to people. They did so much to us, maybe we fight back, but it's a very like one-sided picture, right? It's like capital, the government is just gunning us down, and then we kind of try to respond, we try to come up with some stuff, but it's often just like that kind of reactive view of history. It's like they have all the power. We just happen to like kind of try to work stuff out, but there's all this repression, so we're not very good at it. I actually think that's not right at all. And I think it's an important kind of error that disempowers us and helps us miss when real big things happen in history. So what I'd say instead is that it's a dynamic between classes in a system that produces perpetual avenues of resistance. Kind of like the Marx quote, right? Like, as society gets restructured, there's new places we struggle, new people come together and struggle, and then it's not just capital imposing things on us, but often workers coming up with creative things that start to destroy capital's way they organize society, and they have to go on the defensive, right? So it's not just like a one-sided fight, but it's a back and forth between different forces with their own creativity, their own ways of struggling and understanding struggle. That's the concept of class recomposition, which is essentially that new production, new forms of social organization create new struggles. And based on that, capital has to try and figure out a way to control it, put it down, and deal with it. And that these things keep recurring, coming up. Another way to say that is that autonomous workers' power forces reorganizations and changes in capital. That's really important because you could read thousands of left newspapers and never actually see that point. All you could see is that workers respond and try to fight back, but you never actually recognize that there are times where we in our community, maybe not even consciously, impose things on the system. And that capital can't be understood as an outside force working on the working class, but instead it is inside, it's internal to this whole class system. Or in other words, capital is always trying to swallow up the working class as labor power, but the working class affirms itself as independent, blah, 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 blah. Basically, you know, they're trying to control us and extract money, wealth, and our time all the time. But at every stage in history, workers start to put forward new proposals, new ways of understanding it that threaten to destroy their whole regime. And that's kind of paraphrasing some autonomy of people, Italians from the south. So this is another picture of Fordism. It's called Fordism, also called Taylorism, or the mass assembly line model of production dominated turn of the century. You can see from this picture, right? You have a bunch of workers all working on the same stuff, simplified movements. Interesting thing, for every model of production, I got a quote from somebody on the left who supported these capitalist organizations of work, which is something to think about, and we'll come back to that too. So Lenin said, we must organize in Russia the study and teaching of the Taylor system and systematically try it out and adapt it to our own ends, same time in working to raise the productivity of labor. We must take into account specific features, blah, 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 blah. And at the end you see, so that the slogan of the dictatorship of the proletariat should not be desecrated by the practice of lily-livered proletarian government. What was Lenin talking about? He's talking about how you organize workers under capitalist management forms to extract greater forms of labor. It's a pretty damning quote. So what does it mean? Taylorism, Fordism, all this stuff. Think of I Love Lucy. If anybody's ever seen that episode where she's on the assembly line with the chocolates, she can't slow it down. She kind of ripped it off from, Charlie Chaplin. That's kind of the essence of the Fordist assembly line. You have usually literally a belt, an assembly line, a series of workers all fulfilling those same tasks, unable to stop the machines, totally at the mercy of the line itself. And it all came out of time studies done by this guy, Frederick Taylor, who actually was a worker in a factory. What he did is he took a stopwatch and he said, how long does it take you to do this particular motion? Before this, you had lots of like skilled craftsmen, right? You know, think of medieval times, people making beautiful ironwork, all these kinds of very complicated things. Every house that was built was different. So what Taylor found is that if you simplify the physical movements involved in creating things, you can immensely speed up production through these time steps. So in other words, rather than having people think and use their creativity and their skills as a skilled worker, just have someone screw a single bolt on in a movement that's been studied where they don't really have an option to stop doing so, and you can produce all these cars that are perfectly similar, a much more rapid rate, etc. So that's essentially standardization of the motion steps and methods to reduce variation between productivity and workers. Because the thing is, you know, if it's all about skill, one worker to the next, you can have totally different quality and not super amount. Another factor that was there was a big increase in managers, essentially, right? If you're going to put people on these assembly lines, it's pretty dehumanizing. You have no way of stopping it. You're going to need much more people out there ensuring that people don't get out of hand so that the work keeps flowing, things don't get messed up. Fordism was connected to Taylorism because Taylorism let them use the assembly lines, all that stuff, but it was to standardize products to reduce costs. So, you know, before cars were a luxury with Henry Ford, he's like, we're going to use standardization to make things cheap. Then you're going to specialize tools and production, process production for mass assembly lines. Basically, mechanization. This is the first time where mechanization gets like to be a really big thing. Before, there had been steam engines, machines, all that stuff, but the integration of mechanization into an assembly line process was something that Ford came up with. The last piece is increasing wages, right? So you make your cars cheaper by reducing costs of production, speeding up the amount you can put out, and then you start to pay people more so that they can afford to buy the products you produce. Because before that whole era, working people didn't buy stuff as much. There were things they bought to sustain themselves, but in terms of consumer goods, cars, advertising, all the things we associate with normal life now, that was a specific model of production that Henry Ford developed. But the interesting thing is they kind of came up with this in the 1920s, and it didn't really get put into practice until later in the 30s, which is what was called the social compact, the welfare system, Keynesianism, a bunch of different things. What that did was it took this model of production in the factories, right, and it combined it with government intervention and kind of unions, business working together to create like productive industrial capitalism tied to a consumptive economy, right? So the driving engine is going to be like it is today. People shopping at Walmart, people buying electronics goods, buying autos. through recycling that money that you earn as wages back to capital, that'll be the driving force of capital, which before was not necessarily the case. Unionism getting institutionalized, in a sense, legalized by the government, promoted, businesses even bringing in unions, kind of creating a compact between labor and management, allowed for higher wages. But the important thing to know about this is that if you look at, like, say, the very first contracts of the auto workers, which was like a big moment in union history where unions really got kind of solidified after a period of violence and stuff. One of the first things they put in there is quotas, how much you produce every day. Because before, there had been lots of disruptions, strikes, things where the workers would slow down work because it was dangerous, violent, all that stuff. So when the unions come in during this era, one of the first things they do is speed up production so that you're getting higher wages, but at the same time, you're producing more and you lose control over your own work. So part of this whole model was the government, the unions, creating a more stable environment where there wasn't as much worker struggle, and in exchange, capital was exploiting workers at a higher rate than before when it was more out of control, there was more disruptions. Part of that was provision of social welfare by the state and industry to try and keep down those violent strikes, militant actions, all that stuff. So that's when Social Security, Medicare, well, Medicare was much later, but basically social provisions. It's different in the U.S. from other places. It's kind of the same thing. It's important to know that it was a global movement, right? That this stuff was happening in Europe after World War II. The U.S. was financing the development of social democracies, universal health care, and all over the world they were creating this kind of union welfare state regime. It developed differently in all kinds of places, but it was right around 1930s, 1940s, 1950s that this got solidified as the dominant way of organizing capitalism. There was a real buildup in technology and also at the same time, unparalleled warfare. Wars were how we got out of the Great Depression, we entered the Cold War, and these are definitely driving things in the economy at the time. It's important to note, no matter what country you're talking about or bloc or axis or any of that thing, you see across the world, peasants, people that are not integrated into the work system being forced off their land and into these capitalist relations. And that's where Lenin comes in, right? His quote is about taking people who are not workers, turning them into workers, and ensuring that they have adequate output. And if whatever you think about Lenin, if you step back and look at that on a global scale, it's the same thing that was happening in capitalist countries, just in a different method. Taylorism, Fordism was being used to turn people into workers and to ensure a stable regime for the development of capitalism, kind of independent of ideology. So then we get into resistance. The problem with an assembly line, as you saw, is you have all these people standing in a line right next to each other doing very simple movements. The thing is, if people are that close, they can talk. And if the work is horrible, people are getting injured, and things are getting sped up all the time, it's very easy to stop the system because all you have to do is stop the assembly line and the whole thing shuts down. You know, auto production, for example, was very centralized. All the parts, the tires, the cars, anything involving auto was all produced in a very small region or country, which means even one factory shutting down could shut down the whole system. And that was a real structural weakness in this model that led to the UAW sit-down. Workers went in, they occupied a building, they shut down production, and in occupying a certain area, they were able to shut down a significant amount of production in the production chain as a whole. That's different from how things are today, and we'll come back to that as well. As this resistance started to flourish, that's where you see the institutionalization and the way that capital was able to change, or there was class recomposition going on. They were able to find a system, the union social welfare system, that integrated struggle into that system without disrupting. And in exchange, people received higher wages, but often much more dangerous conditions with less control over their work than they had had before that regime. Let me see if I get to this elsewhere. No. The interesting thing is if you look at it on a global scale, it started in the U.S. As they start to move production around, they moved it to the South eventually as workers' struggle disrupted it. Every place they moved that same model, it happened, and it happened much quicker that this resistance came up. So it happened in Brazil, South Korea, happened in China, to where eventually they could only shift and displace that struggle so long, because workers learned from it. And from the production situation itself, people just knew how to struggle around that stuff. And that's part of the reason why they have to change the system. There's only so many places you can move it before workers figure it out and start to mess up what you're doing. So the end of Fordism, I found some crazy thing about the gold standard, which there's no shortage of. The gold standard actually played a big role. But we think of the pinnacle of this era, right, 1950s, with the GI Bill, unparalleled employment, wealth in the United States and a lot of the Western world following the Second World War. But at the same time, in former colonial regimes all over the world, there was basically outright insurrections and revolutions. And it's important to note that happened not just in the Western countries, but also in the East as well. In East Germany in 1954, there was massive waves of worker strikes that the Soviets had to put down with tanks. In Hungary in 1956, there was a revolution where workers took control, created workers' councils in the factories, and expelled all the Russian troops. They had to come in with tanks. There was Prague, a series of revolts. In the United States, there was the civil rights movement. There was also student struggles that developed worldwide that became quite pitched. And there was workers' resistance in developed industrialized economies like the U.S., Italy, Britain, Germany, France in May 68, in the hot autumn of 69, 70s, through a series of wildcats, people acting outside the unions. Also, really importantly, but not often discussed, is that there was a mass refusal of work in those same economies. Workplace sabotage and extreme declines in productivity. So you had this system, right, that had been able to contain struggle for a certain point. But what you found is by the 1960s, workers were refusing to go into work. They didn't want to work full-time jobs. They would come in drunk. They'd take hour-long lunch breaks. They'd hide in bathrooms. They would stop production for no reason. And these kind of individualized forms of resistance became enough of a problem that all the capitalists started having meetings and figuring out, how are we going to make these people work? Because people had lost the desire to work and be productive under that system. And in effect, the panorama of this, the worldwide struggles, the disruptions in the factories, and the overall breakdown of that social compact ended the Fordist system. It had to be replaced with something else, because those struggles threatened to basically topple the system. So new forms of rupture and resistance to work, to capitalist extraction of labor, it just killed that labor base, right? The normal means of settling disputes broke down, and that's really important. If they no longer can use the union contracts, grievances, the government, police, to enforce discipline, then you enter into a period of openness where we don't really know what's going to happen. So what'd they do? One thing they did is they opened up China to the world market. Most of this stuff happened under Richard Nixon, but you have a massive situation in which the introduction of capitalism could create new sources of value. The other thing they did is go off the gold standard. I don't want to get into that too much because it's kind of complicated, but basically what it does is it frees up capital to be able to manipulate currency markets and have more money to change the way they produce. World food and price crisis, oil crisis, world recession, and then the Soviet blocs also had similar food and energy crisis. Why are these relevant? Because basically what happens, they go off the gold standard, they start to manipulate the prices of basic goods, and they use all the money they make out of those crises to fund widespread mechanization and changes in how they organize work. And that's kind of where globalization comes in. And this is the container ship, because totally crucial to this was the mechanization of the docks and introduction of standardized forms of shipping, which are containers. Because before that, I should have had another picture, but basically everything was done in bulk. You know, you'd have like big, I don't know, like canvas things that would have wheat, and they'd have to like lift it up. Sometimes people would have to shovel it. It was extremely labor intensive. The amount of goods you could move from abroad was rather limited because of the amount of labor and the power that longshoremen had. Well, we'll come back. Oh, yeah, here it is. Yeah, I'll keep going on that. Yeah. So Cuba, Vietnam, and Algeria, for example, destroyed traditional military regime in the sense that their ability to put down revolts in the Third World was no longer secure because of those revolutions that had occurred. So instead, what they developed was a new regime of low-intensity warfare in Latin America, which is called that not because it was relaxed, but more just because it was done by more disparate forces, kind of working with paramilitary groups on the ground, not having invasions, essentially. And that's where you see all the mass murders in Guatemala, Colombia, where... covering that stuff. This is where the Toyota model comes in. And here's my other quote from a leftist. President Chavez is currently developing an extremely important type of cohesión, which means like co-management, right? Co-management between workers and the bosses in the recovered factories involving a combination whereby the government contributes resources, so state funding, the bosses their assets, so working with capitalists, the workers their labor, and in the administration of the firm, their participation. The interesting thing is, people on the left call this revolutionary. They call it co-management, like a new kind of socialism. But it's actually the same as Toyotaism, which we'll see is kind of ironic here in a second. So there's a bunch of different names for it. I don't know why there's so many, but just-in-time production, because one change that occurred was with the Fordist model, you have all that centralized. You're making everything together. And you have warehouses where you store stuff. There's bulk goods. They said, let's change that. Let's only produce based on immediate demand. So we're not going to stockpile anything. Part of the reason for that is it allowed them to make production decentralized. They don't need to produce everything in the same place. They just produce what they need when they need it, and then they ship it. It's also called, lean and mean. It's just stupid economics terms. Toyota model, because it developed in Toyota factories in Japan, mostly in the 70s, but it wasn't really perfected till the 80s and 90s. Also, continuous improvement, or Kaizen, which you may hear from like corporate speak at your jobs. And the reason is because on the Toyota assembly line, they put more power in the hands of the workers, more power. And the idea is if you give workers the ability to improve work, continuous improvement, that you'll be more productive. And so they have all these little councils where you get together and you say, oh, I've got an idea. Now, if your idea is we should get paid more and we need healthcare, you get fired. But if your idea is, oh, if we do this little thing, we'll be able to produce more in the same amount of work, then they're like, good job. That's cohesión, or co-management. It's having works councils where management and labor sits down together and comes up with solutions that benefit the business. The difference is, on the auto line, like in Japan, the early ones, they would have like a cord you could pull where you could stop the assembly line. Because the problem was things were being broken on the assembly line, as we all know from like Fords and American automobiles. They're not very reliable. And part of the reason was because the line just keeps moving. If shit's broke, you just got to keep going. And it doesn't matter. And unless quality checks catch it, you just don't know. You know, I have auto worker friends who say, don't buy a vehicle that was bought on or made on a Friday, which I guess you can tell on the door, because they're like, everybody's trying to get out of there, so there's a lot of air. With Toyota, they allowed people to stop the line, which was like the biggest thing. That was in the UAW contracts. You never stop the line. That was like the most important thing. But with Toyota, they said, you can stop the line if you're going to fix things. What they combined that with to ensure that there was enough productivity was making the work much more skilled, reducing the amount of workers, mechanizing things, and at the same time giving workers a sense of control or autonomy. But the net effect of it was a labor speed up. So even though you feel like, oh, I can stop the line, things are better in this new model, the net effect is actually that you have way more work. It's just that you are imposing work on yourself rather than a boss, which is interesting. So we covered some of this flexible, decentralized production chains, highly skilled workers with fake autonomy, and work teams. You would often do it in groups rather than assembly lines. You'd have like a group of people all working on a section of a car, moves on. Precarious labor was another component of that. Not as much in Japan, but in the United States version, they're like, what if we take this shit and then we just don't give anybody benefits and we have people quit all the time so that they're not tied to the job? This is from some Indian radicals who live in the industrial part of India, and they were there when all this stuff got introduced in the factories, because it started in auto, spread to every industry. And they kind of go over some time studies based on their experiences, things they picked up. So in the Fordist assembly line, right, you're going to be occupied 45 seconds of every minute that you're working. Flexible production is the other name for Toyotaism. It's 57 seconds of every minute. The interesting things that, yeah, so in Japan and England, they make 20 movements every 18 seconds. And one of the rise you saw was introduction of a system where you have more control, more autonomy, all these sorts of things, right? Is that you had sudden deaths on the shop floor, which in Japan, they called karoshi. They had to invent a term because it was a new public health that happened with the introduction of the system. So, as these new production techniques developed, there was a global revolution in electronics and computers that drove this, right? They had kept moving production all over the world, trying to keep workers' struggle down, and eventually they run out of steam. But the way they found to make more money was they say, look, we can change all this production by introducing a whole new industry. Developed in the 60s, I mean, even earlier than that. But the introduction of computerized production allowed for these more decentralized forms of production, skilled work, and grouping it in those methods. Today, Toyotaism is applied from grocery stores to hospitals. In hospitals, you actually have the same Kaizen works committees where you're improving your work. They combine an environment of surveillance where they know everything you're doing, so they can do passive time studies. They don't even need to pay somebody to do it. It's integrated into the software of everything you do. All your movements are monitored. They're constantly reorganizing production based on the feedback between these and using employees to try and, get invested in this. Even small cafes have elements of flexible production, specifically like those works councils. Starbucks, you're not a worker, you're a team member. They have, these weekly meetings and all that kind of stuff. And I think that's something that actually happens in history in general, is that revolutions in one area or in one industry will quickly and rapidly reorganize the rest of society. Likewise, workers. I'm not really going to talk about this stuff because it's too complicated and maybe not that interesting, but neoliberalism around the world, big deal. It was a part of all this, right? As they disassemble centralized areas of production, primarily in the Western world, the United States, Europe, they decentralize it all over. Part of the way that they keep making money and do capitalist development is called neoliberalism, where they force countries to sell off state assets and break down the union. It actually started first in England and the United States under Reagan and Thatcher, but then they used it in other places in the third world as well. It is an interesting fact that we got it first. The whole deal with all this stuff, with Toyotaism, is that it was about imposing austerity to make people want to work. People didn't want to work. They were over it. They were living a good enough life where discipline started to break down, and they were putting real challenges on the system to where they weren't sure if capitalism was going to survive. So they had to find a way to make us like really psyched to work and to want to go to work, and especially to work under more oppressive conditions. This was tied to a new cycle of primitive accumulation. That just means taking things that weren't under capitalism and putting them into capitalism, essentially. And we're talking there mostly about the third world, China, India, Brazil, Korea, places like that that were newly proletarianized, where people turned into workers from former peasant areas, tribal areas, indigenous areas, natural areas. But this is part of the controversial stuff, I think. I think neoliberalism is over. We had a series of crises. I mean, I could go back even a little further with the saving and loan crisis, but we have the dot-com bust, financial scandals around September 11, and we have the present crisis. There was also the collapse of the Asian Tigers, which was similar to our crises. It just happened about 10 years earlier in the strong Asian economy, Japan, Korea, in Argentina. In my mind, it was one of the big ones. Argentina had been the primary neoliberal model, one of the model states for that stuff, and their economy completely imploded in 2001 primarily. And out of those ruptures in that social system, people started talking about the end of the Washington Consensus. From that rupture in that moment, it spread across all of Latin America. And that's not to say neoliberalism doesn't exist there anymore, but it's no longer unquestioned, dominant, and easily imposed on people. And there's competing models of capitalist development. There was also renewed global workers' resistance. There's been more strikes in China since the introduction of these models than in all of human history in China alone in the past 10 years. South Korea, Vietnam, India, Latin America, there's just been widespread, massive worker struggles since the introduction of this stuff that's thrown the system into a crisis. And that's the title, neoliberalism was fueled by debt spending in a consumptive regime. And obviously, at this point in time, that has been totally destroyed. So whether or not you think neoliberalism is still there or not there or whatever, that method of forcing people to work and containing worker struggle has started to break down, even if it's not completely gone. One thing I think we see out of these various trajectories, right, where you have worker struggle creates new regimes in capital, and then eventually those wear out and worker struggle starts to emerge again and destroy it, is that I think it's important to keep in mind that often at high points of struggle, a lot of the left will end up to the right of the movement itself. I can give some examples of that. 1960s, 70s in the regime of wildcats and workplace sabotage, right? People refusing to work, doing poor labor, bad work. A lot of that felt completely outside of the traditional left and the institutional left, right? It was often against unions. It was often in antagonism to the left that was tied to those union regimes and emerging from forces outside of left of the organizing, even if people might have gone to it later. The Italian hot autumns of 1969 to 70 and 76 were a series of massive factory struggles and strikes, building occupations, people just going into grocery stores, taking everything they wanted, claiming free consumption, that sort of stuff. It saw the organized left in Italy attack those movements. So they saw that as a threat because their traditional base had been in the compromise with unions and the parliamentary left. So those movements came into often violent conflict with the majority of the left in that country, even if small minorities ended up aligning with it. This month, the Communist Party in Greece stood outside of parliament with batons and helmets in front of riot police and basically served to protect the parliament against all the protesters from the majority of Greece. Right? Clear example of the left being on the right of where the people's at when the struggle gets pitched. In Paris, 1968, socialist communist parties used the unions and party infrastructure to bring people back to work. You had students rioting, workers general striking, the whole country shut down to the point where Charles de Gaulle and the government was getting on a plane to flee the country because they thought they had lost the revolution. But the communist and socialist parties were able to use their influence in the workplace to bring people back to work in exchange for a shorter work week in order to stop the revolution. Which, as you can see, these things keep coming up at exactly the wrong moments. Right? So organizing in time of cholera. Cholera is kind of a pun. In Spanish, it can also mean rage. Social rupture creates new protagonists and new forces. But look, in the left, there's people that are invested in the existing arrangements. They like how things stand. They like their groupings. They like the position, the role they play in the movement. And they get threatened by this new recomposition of forces and new struggles. But at the same time, look, there's a lack of experience and preparation by that left. Whatever leadership that left has in those struggles gets augmented or gone beyond. And we have a weird situation where the left is supposed to lead, but often is left behind or to the right of the movement. So I think in these kinds of times, we need to be asking ourselves, what recompositions are going on? What is our role? Given that we're already sick from being on that ship too long and we don't know where the holes are, what role do existing political forces and mass organizations play? And how can we help move things forward and not play that conservative? Make the road by walking. It's a concept I like, or caminando, preguntamos, is like walking. We're asking questions, or we ask questions. The Zapatistas came up with it. It's kind of the concept of we're going to build this movement through our struggles, through these recompositions and our relationships to the organization. I think one thing we've seen through these lessons from history is that struggle is not reducible to the ideas or the interventions by leftist groups, right? Oftentimes it's workers responding to their conditions in production, the changes in capital that produce these new forms and whole new sections of leadership. They have emerged not from existing forces. At the same time, obviously things do not occur magically. There's always people intervening. The problem is we don't know what works and what doesn't. It's very hard to tell. I think it's pretty obvious at this point we've entered a new period. There's new forces. There's new combativity that wasn't there before. Police were always shooting protesters with beanbags, with pepper spray. People died at protests from this stuff. But it's only now that widespread dissatisfaction is churning up around this stuff. Why is that? It's because of this new period. It's a new time in struggle. I think it's important that I don't think we know right now what the new struggles are, what those forces are, where the leadership's going. I do think it's important, though, that the revolutionary forces of tomorrow will be built out of these struggles, right? It's not going to be that somebody cooked it up in 1998 on a flyer, had a conscious, really direct, simple, step-by-step plan, and then they implemented it. A lot of the leadership and the struggle we need are going to learn from the things that are happening right now and are going to be developing in this time. I think it's important to point out, too, that when things start to break down, it's when these regimes are crumbling. It's when there were cracks in Fordism that those struggles emerged. Wildcats, student strikes, revolution of the third world. When the ruling class is strong and when they're able to incorporate our struggles and make them not a problem, when they can just toss us some cash and keep us quiet for a little while, it's hard for things to break out of the normal, kind of hanky-panky of society. But when they're less and less able to do that, that's when real revolutionary potential is opened up. I don't think we're there yet, personally. I think what we're seeing is fights against people taking stuff away from us, and often defensive struggles. You can think of Madison as the most obvious example. They're cutting our living standards, they're taking things away to solve a crisis, and people are responding in a defensive manner to preserve what they have. That's different from going directly and attacking the system in a time when they're not going to be able to respond as well. With Madison, they could kind of quiet things down a little bit. With the Occupy movement, maybe they can, maybe they can't. I think we're in a transitional period right now where we don't yet see where these struggles are going. We don't know who or what is forming them, but we start to see the elements of that stuff as the system starts to come apart. The last part, I just want to put something crazy in there because I like to do that. We need to move towards struggles for expropriation and communization. I'm kind of serious about that, though, in the sense that when the system starts to break down, what we really need to push for is those attacks directly on our exploitation as workers, as people in the community that reproduce profit value for the system. And what that means is starting to take control, right? Not just occupying plazas, but occupying workplaces and not sitting in them, but starting to produce, starting to create our own economy, our own system that goes beyond the one we have today. Because I think there's a problem where you see a lot of the left really tied to what we have now. They're like, we just need more unions, we need slightly higher wages, maybe we need universal health care. But look, as this system breaks down and they're not really in a position to offer that stuff to us, even if they wanted to, those kind of solutions will hold us back. Those are going to be people under Fordism saying that we should keep the unions in even while the unions are speeding up production. And that's not really the position we want to be.
It
did. It got recorded. Yeah. It's all come down. I think we should just have an open discussion. People can ask me questions if they want, but
what you said at the very end, it really makes sense because
A lot of times on the left, there's, I'm sure there's no one in this room, but there's a sort of abrasive doctrinaire, like, I know what's best for you kind of thing. But when you talked about creator-owned economy, I thought about, like, the people who have communes and they make their own electricity and they grow organic food and like that. And they are making alternative ways to survive when, in fact, you know, it might come to where we have to know how to grow things and, you know, really take care of ourselves without electricity. So then I started thinking about those people, and they're like the antithesis of the, you know, they're like the kind of hippie left counterculture. They're the antithesis of the doctrinaire people. But I don't know that they, you know, what their role would be, because a lot of times they sort of eschew any kind of political analysis. So I don't really have a specific question, but thinking of like the grain old heads, you know, who like live on the commune, as opposed to, you know, the real kind of like bossy, pushy Stalinist leftists. Like, what do you see? You see anything existing in the middle?
Yeah, Mark.
I would say that, you know, the kind of hippie, and I wouldn't even use the term left, because they take themselves out of the struggle.
Yeah.
You know, they basically, they've set up liberated areas for themselves, and they're done. They're like, you leave us alone, we'll leave you alone. Of course, capitalism never leaves them alone, and it crushes them. You know, I've talked to people who, you know, have been in various communes, and it always ends up the same thing. They can't keep up with capitalism, and their communes end up getting destroyed. The ones that do succeed often become very capitalistic and very right-wing. Look at Whole Foods, look at all the organic stuff. You know, it was started out as a kind of alternative counterculture that has become billion-dollar businesses. And you know, they attack unions, etc. So I wouldn't consider them, I mean, that's not the left. And even if you talk to people who aren't even there, there's a lot of libertarianism in the kind of rainbow movement. So, I mean, not only not left, but actively right-wing. But what I thought was interesting is this notion of the left always being behind the people when a revolutionary situation arises. And this isn't new. It's not something that happened in the 60s. It's not something that just happened now. It happened, you know, 100 years ago. One of, you know, a lot of people really, you know, they really complain about Lenin's book, What Is to Be Done, but that in fact is Lenin is complaining about that very situation. He's saying, look, you guys are behind the workers, and this is what you need to do to try to catch up with them. And then, of course, people turn it into a religious document, which ends up being behind the workers again, and then being used as a fetter to keep people behind. It's, a couple of years ago, my friend Mike Eli said, it's like, just as generals always end up preparing to fight the last war, and so when a new war breaks out, they're surprised, revolutionaries always prepare to fight the last revolution. And so when new struggles break out, they're always like, what? you know, and I'll say, when the occupation stuff broke out, at my very first instinct was like, God damn it, these guys are taking away from the Stop the Movement demonstration that's going to take place in December. Or in D.C., you know, and hey, great, I was wrong, you know, and I, you know, dive into this thing wholehearted. But I've talked to a lot of people on the old cranky left who are just like, oh, this isn't the way it's supposed to be, and, you know, they're not following my, you know, messiah of choice, or, you know, and I've talked to people who were like, railing again, like, oh, they're just a bunch of kids, they're just middle class, you know, they're just mad that they don't have the positions they were supposed to have. Like, yeah, that's why we have these struggles. That's why workers break out and struggle, because they're not getting what they expected to have. Like, okay, so they went to college, and they have this massive college debt, and they didn't get the middle class jobs they wanted to have. Now they're busboys and waiters and, you know, shop clerks, and, you know, they're workers. They're highly educated workers under mountains of debt, and you're shitting on them because they're not, you know, the people that you expected. Like, struggle breaks out wherever it breaks out. We need to be there and, you know, not just helping build it, but learning from it, you know, and And I, for the longest time, I was like, you know, a really big, like, I didn't like consensus because I thought it was undemocratic, but I'm learning a lot, and consensus is in many ways even more democratic than democracy. So, you know, and then it's not saying it's universal, but, you know, there's a lot we can learn from these new struggles that are breaking out that, you know, I think that's a really important point that happened. I mean, yeah, so.
To go back to the commune point, I think that we need that strain of activity in society of people who are experimenting with living in more sustainable ways and trying to create new societies that are, or ways of structuring society that are more egalitarian, like communes and transition town movement, people like that. And that it's, I think it's the job of the more political people to politicize that. And to, I think it's one facet of an overall movement of society towards something. And we're going to need that skill, you know, to be able to grow food and, you know, to reorganize society in the way they're doing. Now they're an escapist movement, like Mark was saying. They go out and they basically declare themselves irrelevant and that they don't belong to the world anymore. And they, you know, smoke pot in the woods or whatever. And but they're also experimenting with social forms that we need to learn from. So we need to be out there politicizing those people and drawing them into the movement. And the stuff going on in the Occupy places, a lot of it's the same. You know, there are a bunch of people learning how to cook collectively and deal with all the mundane aspects of living together. Yeah, so that's sort of happening through this
struggle too. Yeah, I think one thing that's interesting to me anyway is the way in which things that existed before in this time have been recontextualized. The best example of that is when you look at the occupations of California colleges, people put out some really crazy stuff that was actually pretty funny, and me and my friends used to just laugh at, which was like they said, occupy everything, demand nothing. And everybody laughed at them, you know, because they were like, what the hell are you talking about? Occupy everything, demand nothing? That just sounds crazy. But now it's not crazy. You know what I mean? Now it became the dominant position. And like what a bunch of crazy students at UC Santa Cruz came up with in this context has been fundamentally changed. So I think, you know, under capitalism, as far as co-ops and communes and those experiments can be integrated into the system, I think that stuff becomes non-threatening and can just reproduce capitalism. But I think in a context now, the kind of occupations and experimentations with social forms could be changed, right? I mean, in Argentina, during 2001, people seized factories that had been abandoned and started production, which could be a co-op, but in that context, it was very radical because there had been a vacuum. And workers started to create a new economy with each other. If capital hadn't gotten that under control, it could have spiraled out of control and gone in a really good direction. So I think, yeah, I think there's definitely problems with that stuff. I'm critical of it. But in these times, who knows, that stuff may change.
So you have any specifics, though, about creating our own economies? Because as we've all kind of touched on, the existing ones can be very bourgeois.
Yeah.
Well, mostly.
I just wanted to pick up on it. Your last point was, I don't remember exactly how you stated, but how to transition through to expropriation and create our own parallel system. So what is that process? It seems like these people doing these experiments are somewhat on that road, if they don't match or integrate totally into the revolution or whatever. So it seems like those are, you know, experiments in that direction, and what would you suggest might be a pathway in that direction that they may not be exploring?
Well, for me, I think human being experiences for the past 200 years have shown clearly there can be no alternative under an existing system. That would never exist. We have shown it. People, working class people in England, they try to do communes. In the United States, we try to do communes, the Occupy movement, you know, and it's been proven that all of those struggles end up in the hand of capitalism. There can be no such thing. I think we have to be able to define priorities. And to have an existing system, we need first revolution. We need a transformation, we need organization. And so we need a process in order to enter a new era. And so therefore, I think, and this one thing that is missed in this thing, there is a critic of the left, but also the critic of the left failed to mention most of those organizations that exist at the time, whether in France, in the United States, or internationally, were organizations that were already in the process of degeneration. There were that struggle throughout the 50s and the 60s, what we call the anti-revisionist struggle that existed. They were pointing out those organizations were bourgeois organizations. There is no way on earth they would have led a revolutionary process. There is no way on earth they would have led a revolutionary struggle. And the recomposition of that movement was being addressed at this moment, at this time in the 60s, in the 40s, that we needed a new concept. We needed a dialectical relationship with the left, with the working class. And we needed all those in order not to reproduce the same mistakes. And I think we are also at this moment facing the same situation. I think we have been a discussion on the circle with my friend here, Steve, on the same question. There cannot be no alternative to capitalists without destroying capitalism. That will never happen. Whatever we do, whatever we do, we probably have more chance of winning the battle than getting an alternative within capitalism. Because that's why I think the last time that our discussion we had, we try to make a difference between capital and the capitalist class. Capital have its own dynamic. Whatever we do under capitalism, I think Mark just took the example, Whole Foods. I used to go to Whole Foods, I stopped. They grind shit for my prison labor. Mm. All their tilapia is being brought from prison labor. So Whole Foods, all those guys who started Greenpeace, when I was growing up, who started as a radical movement, end up now being a capitalistic project. So we need to, and I think this is reformism if we think at this moment, after 200 years history, we're still repeating the same theory that we could have an alternative under capitalism. We could have a little spark under the sun of capitalism. That will never happen. History has already proven it, debunked that theory. Now, again, if we do expropriation without class power, it is going to be crazy. I think we've been having that discussion. There cannot be, again, expropriation without class power. Expropriation needs rules, needs laws. You need all this because a bunch of crazy people will go out there and expropriate without organization. It needs centralization, not bureaucracy, but it will need centralization. So it will need also the basic of having a revolutionary organization, a revolutionary movement. It will need to have a class that basically guide expropriation, because I think we need to differentiate. There is a structure and there is practice. Expropriation is part of the practice, same as repression, same as democratic rights, and there is a structure. The structure is whatever we call is democracy, is dictatorship. That is the structure. And to this structure, there could be practices made. And expropriation is at the level of practice. If we take expropriation outside the structure, it becomes a very dangerous thing. We cannot disconnect this, the combination of structure and practice, because it will be very dangerous. So that's a discussion we will be having. Let's say that those people, we have a concrete example. If we expropriate government center now, all those looper, those drug addicts, all those people, just imagine that reality that we have now on the Occupy movement all over. Everybody been saying the same shit. All the Occupy movement. We have homeless people, look them. Everybody in the Occupy movement. Let's say that all those people decide to go expropriate City Hall. You know what the fuck? There will be a civil war right inside those things. Because it cannot be done without a political line. It cannot be done without a discipline. It cannot be done without an emerging ideology guiding it. And this is why this moment, the struggle we're having on the circle, is very important. It is not an intellectual debate. It is a thing that is giving us an emerging theory, an emerging ideology. Without this, there will never be a line on expropriation. We need to have a line on expropriation.
Can I respond to that instead? Do you want to go too? Sorry? No. I think that's right. You know, I mean, basically when we're talking about expropriation, we're talking about a situation in which the system is crumbling, and it's not to build something inside capitalism, but we're talking about once we're in a revolutionary situation, which I said we're not really there. You know, the existing means of settling disputes is still there. People are fighting back because they're being attacked, but we're not in a full-blown crisis yet. That's how I think, Chris. But the problem is, and I've tried to raise this, that, look, the existing left is sick. You know, we have opportunists. We have people that are so tied and so individualistic that they're going to be very destructive. And I think you do need a structure for expropriation, but the problem I'll raise with people is, look, throughout history, it wasn't just one tendency of the left that was sick during a single period. I'd say what Marx said is that in every period, probably the majority of the left ended up in a conservative role because they're tied to the capitalist system, just like everybody else. The left is not outside the normal relationship. The left reproduces everything from society in the same way that other people do. So I think the thing we have to recognize is that we don't have what we need. We need to build what we need. And most of that will be built in struggle. So I think, yes, we need structure for revolution. We need a line. But the problem, if you're like, we need a class guiding it, is that's not us in this room. And we don't even know who it is. And probably most of us in this room, that class is going to be fighting against.
Oh, God.
So I think in my mind, one thing we just need to raise within the left is that a lot of people are going to put out proposals that are going to be about saving capitalism. We're saving a variant of capitalism. There's a lot of social democracy people are putting out, which is just a form of capitalism. And if things are becoming unhinged, we don't really know yet. You know, one can imagine or anticipate, but we have to see that already there's a lot of people in our own ranks, probably the majority, that are against that, that are going to try and keep the existing social relationships that are hurting us all. So I think we do need to struggle against it and fight that, but I think we have to be real careful because we're a part of the problem. At the same time, we're a part of the solution, and there's no way of getting clean before we're already in the muck.
I wonder if people have read The Parable of the Sower by Octavia Butler. Because that is a really interesting illustration when you have expropriation without class consciousness. Because then anyone who has anything more than you becomes the rich. And so it creates a really terrible, kind of hellish society.
You have one more sticker bar, huh?
So, you know, class struggle and class overthrow, I think, really has to be at the center of our political project, and class power, you know, of the working class. And I want to also agree that those examples of the left becoming conservative, that is something we have to watch out for. We can see it happening very clearly now with every, you know, sort of liberal politician out there trying to log on to the Occupy movement. But those are establishment left, and we can distinguish between establishment left and the ones who are, like, economically tied into the system and the ones who are trying at least to be genuinely against the system. Like, there is a communist party in Greece who is fighting against the establishment communist party. In the street, they were, you know, fighting against each other. So you can, they're not all like that. So, anyway.
Thanks again for listening to the One Struggle talk at Florida International University, October 29th, by Scott Nopoulos of Miami Autonomy and Solidarity. You can check out more things from One Struggle at onestrugglesouthflorida.wordpress.com or Miami Autonomy and Solidarity's website at miamiautonomyandsolidarity.wordpress.com. Thanks for listening.